I'm David Suchet, and this is Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wansell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Blood Ties. And thank you all so much for listening. It means a great deal to Molly and I. And it's always nice to think of you out there in these stressful times. Here we are, 8 weeks into lockdown. It seems like an eternity.
No, it's funny. I was listening back to last week's episode. I was saying to Dad, and I was very determined about the fact that the lockdown wouldn't be relaxed, and I was totally wrong. So it's good.
Well, we have yet to see what impact it's going to have on the R number, which is clearly decisive. And we also have yet to see what's going to happen, because the week ahead promises to be very sunny and warm in large parts of the United Kingdom, which is going to tempt some people to travel to a beauty spot or the coast, even though everyone's saying, please don't come. Blackpool's got a sign saying, do not visit Blackpool. Don't go to Wales. Don't go to Brighton. Don't go to Chester. Don't go to Liverpool. And where exactly people are going to go in their cars is something of a mystery to me.
I know. It will be the same in London. All the parks, you'll be so full you can't be. I mean, not that they've been, but you won't be able to be 2 metres apart from people.
No. I mean, it's very, very difficult to sustain that kind of discipline in warm weather. I mean, I went out this morning at 8 o'clock. It was deserted. Yeah. London, my bit of London was deserted. But by 10 or 11, you can't move in any of the squares near me. I mean, people try, but it's so difficult. I mean, you see pictures of people cycling up the Mall. There are no cars, but there are so many cyclists. It's incredible. It's mystifying. I mean, but I suppose people think, well, it's outside, so it's got to be safer.
Well, I think it is safer being outside. I think that must be the case. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it is. Obviously, I don't know. I'm no scientist, no expert.
I'm no expert too. And as you often remind me, Molly, I'm in the elderly, vulnerable
group. I often remind you of that. That's unfair. We were having a conversation yesterday about getting people out and about, and, you know, it's not my fault you're over 70, you know?
it's not entirely mine either. I just seem to have hung around for a long time.
We'd like you to stick around, so if it means you have to be extra careful, then so be it.
To be fair, Mo, I am being very careful. I really do not go out very much at all. And I am self-isolating with the help of excellent deliveries from my favourite Indian restaurant and excellent wine deliveries from the nice guys that you introduced
that was a triumph.
Oh, absolutely. First rate. I mean, really, really excellent. And they're so speedy and quick. And yes, I mean, you pay a tiny bit more, but it's well worth it. And they're very reliable. I mean, it's, and I'm lucky enough to have been quite used to being on my own, you know, for long stretches of time. It's not as difficult as it might be for some. And I do appreciate, I mean, clearly appreciate how difficult it is for some people to deal with being cooped up.
Yeah, I mean, we've got it lucky, really, with we've got a nice place to live and we don't have small children or, you know, disabled or elderly relatives or sick people or there's not hundreds of us in one house or so.
No, and I don't live on the 21st floor of a massive tower block, which would be very, very difficult. You know, how do you stay 2 metres apart in a lift? So I'm still struggling to see how that works. For example, in your office, I know you're not in your office, but to get to your office, there's only one lift.
Yeah, it's very small.
And you have to go up. and it's very small, and it's six flights up to where the lift stops, and then it's another flight to where your offices are. Now, how are you going to get the staff up there? I suppose they're all going to have to tramp up the stairs.
I mean, yeah, it's happened before with the lift being broken, but it's not ideal, although probably good for your health. No. We've had a lot of nice messages on Instagram again this week. I thought we should. We've had even more overnight, Dad. I haven't even had a chance to tell you about. Oh, we've just had another.
Oh, good.
Another two followers. Jeffrey and I absolutely love the Instagram followers, don't we, Dad?
We do. Absolutely.
I had a message here overnight from David and Joan. They said they're also in their mid-70s and have just found out what podcasts are and how to use them. And they like our podcast very much and say thank you for keeping them entertained.
It's a pleasure, David and Joan.
James,
thank you for writing to us.
Says, thank you so much. He's been through a bit of a tough time and he's Blood Ties has been an enormous pleasure to listen to and very reassuring. That was nice. Someone said that their new obsession was the Blood Ties pod, and they put it on their Instagram stories. I was very pleased about that. Overall,
me too.
Just been very, we very much like all of your messages. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate them, and Molly appreciates them enormously. We love hearing from you. I got a delightful email from one of our regular correspondents, Phil Brown.
Hi, Phil.
This week, who was asking me what the book I recommended was about a siege in a school in Somerset, which is very good. I reviewed it in January in the Mail. It's called 3 Hours, and it's by Rosamund Lehman. So I
think it's on our Insta somewhere.
I think it probably is. I also replied to Phil saying we're actually doing one of his suggestions today.
Ah, well, that leads us neatly on to today's subject. Who are we doing today, Dad?
It's a man called David Anthony McCreevy, who is known in the tabloids as the Monster of Worcester and in others as the Friday the 13th killer.
Okay, today we're doing the Friday the 13th killer.
This is a story that really does break my heart because it's almost inexplicable. It's not a serial killer with lots and lots of different victims in all kinds of different places. It's one monstrous act. But let's begin at the beginning. David McCreevy was born in Southport in Lancashire in 1951. He was the second of six children to Tom and Bella McCreevy. Tom McCreevy, his dad, was a sergeant in the British Army, and the couple and their children moved around a good deal. Their son David was a cocky, arrogant, know-it-all little boy who developed into a troubled teenager. He always thought he knew best. His friends at the time at school described him as over cocky, but he wasn't, I fear, very bright. And so at the age of 16, no doubt with his father's encouragement, he joined the Royal Navy. He thought, a nice, safe career in front of me, you know. Nice bit of orderly, disciplined life. See the world, you know, girl in every port. A young man with an eye to the future. The trouble was, this career that he'd hoped to carve out in the Navy wasn't really helped by the fact that he had developed quite quickly a considerable appetite for alcohol. To put it politely, he became a very heavy drinker indeed. And when he took to the drink, he got violent. It was later to be suggested that he might actually have suffered from some kind of specific disease which only requires a very small amount of alcohol for people who suffer from it to become very violent. That's never been proved, but it was simply a suggestion that was put forward. Anyway, I'm afraid in the end, in August 1971, when he was 20, he was court-martialed for starting a fire that destroyed a mess. I mean, he said, oh, it was nothing, it was only a joke, but, well, the Navy took it very seriously and pretty much threw him out. So here was this, what he'd hoped to be, an answer to his life, which turned out to be not an answer. And here another bit of fantasy comes into play in the story of David McCreevy. He returns to live with his parents, who by now had moved to Worcestershire, which is a sort of leafy county in the West Midlands of England, with a famous cricket club and ground right by the River Severn. And he became fixated on his fiancée. He decided that he wanted a great big white wedding. Now, his fiancée was young, a young woman, but not much different in age from him. Wasn't fussed at all. Quite happy to have gone to the register office. But no, he'd got this fantasy in his mind that he was going to be, it's going to be a big white wedding and there's going to be cars and she's going to wear a big white, long white dress. But on top of the fact of this fantasy life, he hadn't lost the habit of drinking heavily. And unfortunately, he wasn't particularly kind to his fiancée. I'm not suggesting for a moment that he beat her, but I would say he behaved badly. And in 1972, not long before the supposedly wonderful white wedding, she broke up with him. Now, McCreevy's mum and dad were finding him increasingly difficult, Tom and Bella McCreevy. And I think probably, to be fair to them, at the end of their tether, they told him he had to move out. Sorry, you can't stay here anymore. You've got to move out. Well, that too must have come as a remarkable shock to the young
McCreevy. How old is he at this stage? Or we're not sure.
Well, he's about 20s. Yes, he's in early 20s. And here the story really does turn even more tragic. McCreevy moves in with a childhood friend called Clive Ralph, who has recently, well, comparatively recently, married his childhood sweetheart, Elsie Clay, who became Elsie Ralph. They actually got married in 1968 when Elsie was only 16 but was pregnant. He was 21, 5 years older than she was. And by the time McCreevy moves in with them, and it's a small terraced house in the Rainbow Hill district of Worcester. Cramped, small back garden, not much room. On the other hand, they were glad of the money. He was paying them £6 a week as rent. And by the time he moved in, there was not only Paul, the son, who'd been born in 1968, but there was also a daughter, Dawn Maria, who was born in 1971. And when McCreevy moved in with Clive and Elsie, Elsie was pregnant with the third child, Samantha Jane, who was born in September 1972. So you have a cramped terraced house, home to three small children, a husband and wife, and now their lodger. McCreevy helps out in the house, at one point cooking the Sunday lunch And after the birth of Samantha Jane, when Samantha Jane's about 6 or 7 months old, Elsie, her mother, gets a job in as a barmaid in a local pub called the Punch Bowl Tavern, about 2 miles away from the house. So now McCreevy is not just sort of helping out, he's babysitting for the three children. The story becomes a little murkier. According to the neighbours, McCreevy was very, very good with the children. Excellent, liked children enormously. At one point, I think he remonstrated with Elsie for disciplining Paul, the eldest, you know, saying, no, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that sort of thing. Subsequently, there were suggestions, always denied by Elsie, the mother, that there was some kind of relationship with McCreevy. She denied it then and denies it still. But this all takes us to the tragic events of Friday, April the 13th, 1973. Clive is working as a lorry driver for his father, his father's firm, and Elsie's got a job at the Punch Bowl Tavern. David McCreevy goes out drinking with a friend. They drink quite a lot, and by quite a lot I do mean quite a lot, 7 pints of lager, whatever. And then the McCreevy and the friend fall out. There's a row between the two of them. One report suggested that McCreevy got so angry he dropped his cigarette into his friend's beer. Anyway, there's a row. Clive Ralph turns up at the pub to collect McCreevy because it's become his habit to go and help Elsie close down the pub where she's working, the Punch Bowl, at 11. Have a pint. He's been driving all day. Goes to collect her. Helps her shut up the pub. Has a pint. Drives back home. Clive delivers McCreevy back to the house at around 10:15 that Friday evening and sets off the 2 miles or so to collect Elsie and help her shut up and bring her back home again. Now, we cannot say for certain what drove McCreevy to commit the massacre that he did. And it's heart-rending. But at some point between 10:15 and 11:15, and it's surmised about 10:30 that Friday night, the 13th of April 1973, McCreevy loses his admittedly always short temper. Samantha, the baby, is crying and crying. I would have thought probably for her bottle. You know, she's only a few months old, 8 months or so. And for one reason or another, McCreevy completely loses it. Yes, he's been drinking. Yes, he's probably in a bad temper. But, and it almost beggars belief, he puts his hand over Samantha, the baby's mouth, to stop her crying, and then proceeds to fracture her skull and kill her. But, and here's the astonishing thing, he doesn't leave it there. He proceeds to kill the other two children. He cuts Dawn's throat with a razor blade, which he finds in the bathroom, and he strangles Paul with a wire. The two older children are both asleep.
Violent. It's a kind of vast leap into really extreme violence.
Yes. It's almost defies belief, doesn't it?
It does. It seems...
It seems like a psychotic break.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a break. But the trouble was, the horror didn't even end there.
What?
McCreevy goes down into the basement of the house and retrieves a pickaxe, which he proceeds to use to mutilate the three now dead children.
Awful.
But it doesn't even end there. He then takes these three innocent children's bodies out into the back garden of the house and impales them on spikes of the railing to a neighbour's.
That is extraordinary. He must have had an argument with Mr. Ralph. I can't remember his first name. Clive. Something must have triggered him.
Something else.
But to display the bodies like that is a direct, you know, he must have been cross. Maybe he was cross. He was made to come home or had to stop drinking or, you know, feels like a real display of against someone.
Anger.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. That rage. Well, I'd like to come back to what that might have been. When we come towards the end of the story, McCreevy shuts the door of the terraced house in the Rainbow Hill district of Worcester and starts to walk the streets. By the time Clive and Elsie return from the Punch Bowl Tavern, the police are at the house because someone has noticed something strange. They do not find the bodies immediately, but they do find a great deal of blood in the house. It isn't until a little later, that not surprisingly, the police take Clive and Elsie to the police station. They don't let them in the house. Not long after 1 a.m., the police are searching the house. A constable with a torch goes out into the garden.
And finds them.
And finds the three children impaled on a fence. It was said at the time that it was the single most horrifying thing that the constable had ever seen in his life. And one detective who arrived not long afterwards was physically sick. It was an act of barbarism, depravity, horrifying violence. And there really was only one possible
suspect
candidate for the killing, and that was of course David McCreevy, who was found wandering the streets not far away just before 4 a.m. that morning. He was asked to accompany the police to the police station and at first looked a bit bemused by it all. But some hours later, still in the morning, he admitted, it was me, and then added, but it wasn't me. As if there was another character, individual, hiding in his body.
I can imagine you would feel like that. Anyway, sorry, I'll carry on.
No, absolutely, quite right to interrupt me. But he went into the most sordid, graphic detail into the killings for the benefit of the police, leaving no one in the slightest doubt that he had indeed killed these poor, innocent children, 4, 2 and a few months old, in a fit of something, rage, violence. He could give no explanation beyond the fact that he wanted the baby to stop crying All I was hearing was kids, kids, kids. As if he'd disappeared into some kind of trance. That's not to forgive him, not for one second. How could one possibly? He was obviously in control of his senses. He may have drunk a great deal, but he was still patently sane. He was intent, not on denying that he did it, but perhaps glorying in it. One of the things that marks his case out is that McCreevy pleaded guilty in court on the 28th of June 1973, just a matter of months after the killings. He offered no defence. There was no plea of diminished responsibility, no plea of mitigation. The hearing lasted for 8 minutes. McCreevy was never a character of folklore, as, for example, many other killers of children are, because it was almost over before it began. And it wasn't until the Daily Mirror and the Sunday Mirror began to look into the case that the true nature of the crimes began to come to the surface. By that time, they dubbed him the Monster of Worcester and had speculated that he and Elsie, the mother of the three children, were involved in an affair. He was given three terms of life imprisonment with a minimum term of 20 years and was effectively sent to protective custody as the killer of three children. The impact on Worcester, leafy county town in the Midlands of England, was enormous. But it didn't spread throughout the country, or indeed throughout the world, as some other more famous crimes have done. McCreevy became, well, if not forgotten, but certainly ignored. He was to spend many years in jail. He was considered for release on a number of occasions. And in fact, in 2006, he was transferred to an open prison and allowed to stay in a bail hostel in Liverpool. Unfortunately for McCreevy, he was spotted and photographed by the Sun, who pointed out that the Monster of Worcester was walking the streets of Liverpool. There was an enormous outcry. He was taken back to closed prison. He campaigned, and I think with some justification, that he had been in prison for a very long time and he was a quite different person. And on 2008, he appealed again to the parole board. The newspapers wanted to report the case, and in 2009, an anonymity order was placed on his parole hearing. Still, there was an outcry, not least from Elsie, who had, by this point, remarried and relocated to somewhere else in the British Isles. In 2013, the High Court lifted the anonymity order on McCreevy, and the parole board, in 2018, cleared him for release. He was released in June 2019, last year, after having spent 46 years in prison. He is, of course, on licence for the rest of his life. You know, there can be no other offending. He will immediately be returned to prison. And he looks completely different. There is one photograph which is available. In fact, it's the son's photograph from 2006. He's got a shopping bag and he's walking around. But now, as we've kind of got to the end of the story, I want to add just a couple of complications. Baby Samantha had been admitted to A&E on the day she was to be killed. And the notes say, ? Battered baby. But the doctor who had allowed her to be released didn't notice that on the notes. Now, was that an indication of something that was going on in the household? Was it McCreevy that was actually guilty of bruising baby Samantha? Or was it something else in the relationship? We don't know. We'll never know. All we do know is that's an astounding coincidence. So you have two alternative theories, or perhaps they're the same theory. Was there something between Elsie and McCreevy? She's always denied it. Was there something between McCreevy and Samantha? Was there an undertow of violence in this cramped terraced house in Worcester? The honest answer is we'll never know. But it is also, and I'm grateful for Phil to suggest this case to me, because it's not one that I was well known to me. But looking back over it, it contains at its kernel this horrifying thought. What was it that made David McCreevy snap? And that Friday the 13th of April 1973. And the honest, I would have thought there would, but forgive me, I don't know what it is. I can't be sure. All I do know is it's a heartbreaking case.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. There is this cocky, arrogant young man with an appetite for alcohol who, out of the blue, without any motivation at all, kills three tiny children.
Kills three tiny children in a really violent and
horrifying
exploitative way. To put them...
Yes, you don't mutilate the bodies.
To put them on display like that as well. That's extraordinary.
It is, really. And I find it horrifying. Elsie, the wife, is still complaining that he was released. She has an exclusion order. He can't go anywhere near her. She's relocated. He's prohibited from going to certain areas of Britain. And indeed, of course, prohibited from contacting her. But she was insisting, and has always insisted, in a number of interviews, that he should have served 60 years after all he took three lives. There is a particularly, if you're looking at the pictures, there's a particularly sad, poignant picture of the three children and
yes, they're very smiley babies.
They are. All of whom lost their lives to David Anthony McCreevy. So that, I'm afraid, is the monster.
Friday 13th killer. Thanks, Dad. That was really interesting. I had no idea about that case at all.
Yes, I feel after telling it that it's very important to say something cheerful. It's a really heartbreaking story in every way. And there are one or two of those kinds of stories that do literally bring tears to my eyes. A couple in my book, Pure Evil, Rashan Arshad, for example, who killed his children with a baseball bat and went to Thailand.
We did that as a trial case when we first started the podcast, didn't we? We haven't done it again.
Yeah. I don't think we've never...
No, we never broadcast it. It was just a tester back in the day.
Yeah. Back in the day when we were still limbering up.
Now what are we doing? Limbering.
Anyway,
Lolloping.
We're just limbering, yes. Limbering in isolation.
Lolloping along.
I'd like to ask what plans you've got, but have you got any for this coming week?
Well, yeah, I'm giving my masterclass this week, Dad.
Oh, great. You mean this is to the
London Film School.
And you're telling them about what it's like to be an agent.
Or, you know, what they should expect from their agent-client relationship and how to get an agent and how agents work.
Well, crap. I'd like. Can anyone join?
I don't know if I will, but I can send you the link. So yes, you could watch it if you want to.
I'd quite like to see it. When is it?
It's on Thursday.
When is it? Crikey. Well, I've got a meeting. I think at half past two.
No, I'm afraid it's just
exactly
around that time. So unfortunately, you're unavailable. Oh, what a shame.
Well, I'm sure. I'm unavailable. I would really like to see that. I've got a Zoom conference call. I'm afraid that.
Never mind. I've got another of these
big domestics for the world's most evil killers.
Oh, have
week.
You? Interesting.
Yes. It's a very intense domestic. It's a
that doesn't make sense to listeners. Jeffrey is recording interviews for a television program that he does while he's in isolation, and he's just saying he's doing another case next week that is also a domestic case like this one. Yeah.
Yeah, a very violent domestic. It makes rather a change because sometimes, I'm covering for this particular series. World's Most Evil Killers. I'm covering serial or spree killers. People, there's a lot of cases. And it makes a nice change to do a comparatively isolated case like
those,
McCreevy.
Really. Spree killers, big victim list, are more often than not US based, aren't they? Or is that? I mean, that's probably small minded, but a lot of the ones you do are.
No, if that. A lot of those are US-based, but, I mean, we have had that kind of spree in this country. Obviously, the most obvious one being Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. The case we did last week, for example, BTK, Raider, there's a lot of victims. And I've just done another one, a man called, nicknamed the Grim Sleeper, who committed 10 murders and one attempted murder over a long period of time. I have a distinctly kind of gloomy life. I'm self-isolating with a lot of terrible people.
Bit miserable. What have you been watching? Well, you must have finished Money Heist. What have you been?
I only managed 4 seasons. The 5th season isn't on yet of Money Heist. It's terribly good, though. I mean, really, really good. I've been watching a thing called Trial by Media, which is about
you
famous
will love
cases.
That.
I've been enjoying it very much, and it's a docu stream, very good. Again on Netflix, I always seem to find fabulous things. I'm never bored.
When I was a child,
wonderful things to look at.
In the summer holidays, if we ever said we were bored, Jeffrey would go absolutely bananas. He does not. Boredom is not something that is appropriate in the Wansel family. You should never be bored.
No, I don't think
there are a million things that we can do to occupy ourselves. And now we have even more entertainment and all of these things at our disposal. So there really is no excuse for boredom. I'm sure Oscar Wilde, that's unfair. I just am not a fan of his quote. But what does he, isn't it? Oh, no, that's only boring. People are boring at breakfast or whatever. Is that what he said? Something about being boring.
No, I don't think you're in the least boring way. But you were very unboring last week. You made a quiz that we all did on Zoom. It was very good. It was excellent. So, yeah, plenty of good choices.
Oh, yes, I made
available.
You all a quiz, yeah. Mainly just so that I could pepper it with ancient photos of Jeffrey in various guises so everyone could have a good old laugh.
Good laugh, yeah, thank you. Yes, Molly may well be peppering the Instagram feed.
I put a picture of me up in the pink dress so that we could even it out. Jeffrey bought me that pink dress that is a photograph of which is on Instagram. And I made a big fuss about it. It was jolly expensive. Gone down in once or family history, hasn't it, Dad, the pink dress?
It has. It has. Oh, there are so many wonderful memories, though. I mean, there's so many. I'm deeply blessed, I feel you.
Well, thank you, Dad.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you to all the people that help us out, to Poppy Damon, our producer, to my brother Dan, who does the music, my friend George, who did our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, supporting us, to Jeffrey for all of the hard work he does to prepare the stories and tell them to us in a sensitive way, and to you, the listeners, the biggest thanks. Thank you so much. Please write to us on our email, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com, or access us through Instagram or Twitter at bloodties_pod. You can find Jeffrey on his website, and please like and subscribe and leave us a review, because it helps. We'd love to have more listeners, so tell your friends.
Thank you. And as I always say, do please be careful out there.